Ready? Hello, Ted. This is Mother. We have Bill Gardner sitting in the dining room with me, and he is going to tell us how he got involved with Curtis Wright Corporation. Bill?
Yeah, Betty, I thought maybe you might be interested in when I first started flying, would you?
Yes, I think that's good.
Well, I remember as a kid, I always wanted to learn to fly. And I guess this happens to all us young folks when we are young. And I used to jump out of a tree and
pretend you were a parachutist.
Yeah, and put sheets on the wing. I didn't fly very well. I hit pretty hard. Anyway, when I was at the University of New Hampshire and things were getting really pretty rough in Europe. As you well know, Hitler was marching across the continent, but the United States was not involved, and people like Lindbergh were saying, hey, we got to keep our kids out of this war. Yet the government felt, hey, if we do get involved, we're not ready. And they started a program, which you may have heard of, called Civilian Pilot Training. Did you ever hear that?
Mm-mm.
We call it CPT.
I don't remember that at all, Bill.
Yeah, well, the University of New Hampshire got involved and had the CPT program, and I forgot whether it was 39, let's say about 1939. And in my senior year, 1940, I signed up for this CPT program. And the program gave you about, about 40 to 50 hours of flying time, plus a dandy ground school course. And the professor who ran our aerodynamics program at...
Were you in the engineering school?
Yeah, I was getting a degree in mechanical engineering, but I also had a minor in aero, so... I knew this professor pretty well, and his name was Stolworthy, and he taught the ground school for the CPT program. So I went ahead and entered it, and we flew Taylorcraft airplanes, and it was in the winter of 1940, and we had a lot of snow, and we flew out of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and the Taylorcraft we had skis on it. And so my first flying was done with a Taylorcraft with skis. I went ahead and got my flying license, and we flew all around the state. And then the instructor would say, hey, now one of the things you got to watch out for anytime you're flying, especially single engine, you may have an engine failure. So always keep your eyes peeled for an emergency landing strip. And so this... After we'd had a few hours, this one day, he would pull the throttle back, and you were supposed to look out and see where you're going down. And so I had picked this pond, and as we came down closer and closer, I figured, well, I'm going to apply power. And he held his hand on the throttle, and he wouldn't let me, so I had to land on this little pond covered with ice and snow. And that was a good experience.
Wait a minute. Were you on skis then?
And
the
we
plane
had skis,
on skis?
Had skis.
So you,
yeah. Uh-huh. And one of the interesting things, and when we came in and landed on our home strip there in Portsmouth, and you got down to the end of the field, the only thing you had to turn with was rudder. And you could give it full rudder, but you had no brakes, so you couldn't turn around. So what you do is get out of the airplane, lift up the tail, turn around, get back in, taxi back. It was kind of fun.
When did you graduate, Bill?
I graduated in the spring of 1941.
1941. Well, now, is that when you went to Curtis?
Yeah, and Curtis Wright Corporation interviewed all the colleges in the United States, as I recall, or many of them.
They did.
Engineering schools. And I got selected for the University of New Hampshire to go to the engine division at Patterson. And
Patterson, New Jersey.
Patterson, New Jersey. And I reported in there, I think, as I recall, within a week after I graduated, because now it's 1941, and everybody's getting real concerned, so the production's way up on aircraft engines and everything. Needed people right away, so went down there, and I roomed, first I stayed in the YMCA in Patterson for several weeks, and I met several other guys, and we found out that a Miss Robbins in Upper Montclair had a house that she wanted to take in some fellas, and four of us. I remember one guy from Wyoming, one from Colorado. I forgot where the other's from, myself. There were four of us went and roomed there and worked in Patterson and lived in Upper Montclair.
Well, what did you do then? I mean, how did it evolve that you became a pilot for them?
Well, I guess one thing I didn't mention, when I graduated from the university, we had an ROTC program at the university, but this was in the Coast Artillery. So I had, you know, a commission.
You mean your flying was Coast
Artillery? No, the commission was Coast Artillery. The flying, the CPT program was an entirely separate, different endeavor. And so when I got my degree and I went to Curtis, but I still had this commission, second lieutenant in the Coast Artillery. So I hadn't worked at Curtis up until about September, you know, from June, just a few months. Had a hell of a ball because we were working on new engines and I was in the test business and just enjoying the heck out of it. And then I got called up to come on active duty. And I talked to Mr. Long. Does that sound right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's his name.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And personnel, I believe.
And personnel in Curtis Propeller Division.
No. At the time, it was Engine Division at Patterson. I remember Bill Long's name, but it must have been a different person at the Engine Division. And he said, "Hey, Gardner, we can get a deferment for you." And I thought about it a while, and the order said you're called up for 1 year of active duty. And I said, you know, I feel I owe it to the government. I got the Coast Artillery Commission as a second lieutenant, and I got this training. And I feel if I can go in for 1 year and get my job back at Curtis, I ought to do it. And he said, okay, if that's the way you feel. So I went in on active duty in the middle of October of 1941, and I got assigned to Fort Hancock, New Jersey, on a 12-inch gun, a disappearing gun, you know, protecting the coastline. And then Pearl Harbor came, right? December 7, 1941.
Right.
And then all things changed rapidly. And started to snow, it was getting cold, and they moved us out of the barracks and set us up in a tent down on the harbor. I don't know what good that did. And they, believe this or not, and this was a situation, we were really not prepared. And they went through our battery and all the other batteries and took all our water-cooled machine guns, 30 caliber, and went to the machine shop, and we made stands and to hold them on, and we moved them into New York City and set them up on top of all the skyscrapers in New York. And that was the defense of New York City.
That was the defense of New York City.
Right at the end of the year 1941. That was, it was sad. It was on Christmas Eve, 1941, and I was on duty during the night, and spotted a periscope from out in the harbor, and we put searchlight and kind of followed this, and it came up to the net. We had a net across the harbor, so boats couldn't get into New York City unless we had the right code, and the net was open for them. And this submarine came up, and I immediately called 2nd Corps Area Headquarters for identification to see if it was one of ours, and never got any reply back. And 36 hours later, we found out it was a German sub, It went out to Ambrose Light and sunk two of our own tankers right off Ambrose Light.
Oh,
and we never got permission to fire on it. So I was getting...
Well, your machine guns wouldn't have done much good anyway.
No, this was the harbor. We had these, I don't know whether you hit it or not, but we had these 12-inch guns that I was in charge of on the harbor. So we'd had a shot at it, whether we did it or not, or something else. But we never got permission to fire. In the meantime, the damage had been done. So it was a few days later that I was in the officers' club, kind of bemoaning the fact that, gee, this is a hell of a situation, the way things are going. And I was talking to a friend who was a second lieutenant in another battery, and he had the same feeling. His name was Tom Detula. Well, Tom and I had both been through the CPT program. We had pilot's licenses, and we said, oh, I wonder if we can get out of this chicken outfit and get into the Air Force, or the Army Air Corps at that time, I should say. Well, Tom said, heck, that's a good idea. So we went up to the colonel and said, can we get a transfer to the Air Corps? And he said, by no means. And I know why. And the reason was all the officers in the, this was a National Guard outfit we got assigned to that was running these coastal batteries at Fort Hancock. And all the officers would go in to New York City, their homes at night, and leave us second lieutenants in charge. And boy, they didn't want to lose us. We were important to their lifestyle. So Colonel said no. Well, Tom and I were thunk it over, and we said, hey, let's try something. Might not work. So we wrote a telegram to Chief of Air Corps, Washington, D.C., which was probably a little out of order. And we got it and said we had been through the CPT program, we had pilot's licenses, we knew that the Air Force, the Air Corps needed pilots because there were posters all around saying, hey, we need pilots. And could we get in the Air Corps? And within 2 weeks, both of us got telegrams back from Washington to report to Maxwell Field, Alabama for flight training.
There you go. There. Well, the climate was certainly different down there than it had been in New York City on a skytop rooftop.
Yeah, it sure was, because it was early summer when we got to Maxwell. And from there, we went to Orangeburg, South Carolina for primary, where we flew PT-17s, biplane, had a very good instructor, had a lot of fun, learned a lot. And one of the things, he was kind of, this was a civilian flying school that ran the primaries, and he did some tricks with the PT-17 that I think really made me want to be a fighter pilot. In fact, he'd see a freight train going by down below, and he'd look back at me and say, hey, want to see something? He'd peel off and go down, and he'd roll the wheels of the PT-17 along the top of the boxcars. And then he'd pull down in front of the engine, you know, and swirl around, and the engineer would blow the whistle. And that was the kind of the way we went through primary. And then from there, I think we got about, these are roughly true numbers, probably got about 85 to 90 hours in the PT-17. And then moved from there to Sumter, South Carolina, where I flew PT-13s, which is a Vultee single-engine airplane, which we called a Vultee Vibrator. And I think the only interesting thing that I really remember about that is the first time they told us to do a loop, and stuck the nose down, pulled it up, got over the top of the loop, and pulled the stick a little too hard, and she did a snap. And that was my first Immelmann.
Immelmann.
And so we learned a little from that airplane. Then
that's how Bill McCovey spun in and broke his back, you know.
No.
On an Immelmann. Yep.
Really?
Sure.
And I didn't know that.
Right.
Then there was a dividing line. They took us out before we went to advanced, lined us all up on the runway by height, the shortest guy went in and on up. And then they drew a line at 5'9". Well, just to tell you, I'm 5'8". Tom Deptula was probably 5'11". At 5'9", anybody below that went to fighters, and anybody above that went to bombardment. So that was the last I saw of Tom and for a while. And so I went to Moultrie, Georgia, where I flew an AT-6, which was the advanced school for those going to fighters. Of course, with all the flying that we did, we also were attending ground school continuously. And I'd like to just insert here that I knew as much or more about all the ground school because of the excellent ground school I got from this Professor Stolworthy at the University of New Hampshire in the CPT program. I think I learned more about navigation, weather, and on aerodynamic problems there than I did in any of the Air Force schools that we went through. Well, as I mentioned at the beginning, I had already received a commission as a second lieutenant in Coast Artillery, so now I received, when I left the Advanced Flying School, my wings as a pilot in the Army Air Corps. Of course, all the other fellows that were going through at that particular time and had not been commissioned in an ROTC program were also commissioned as second lieutenants. And then my first assignment was at the School of Applied Tactics, which is in Orlando, Florida. And this school had been set up to bring back lead pilots from Europe. Some of these lead pilots had been flying with the AVG, the volunteer group in Europe, and others had been flying with Chenault in China. And these were our leaders down there at the School of Applied Tactics, and I felt this perhaps was the most important thing that happened to me during my history of combat flying, because here I had a chance to fly with some guys that had already had a lot of experience. The other reason that the School of Applied Tactics was set up, well, there were two other reasons. One was to test new equipment. And as you probably recall, the first radar was invented and set up in England, and this had very much to do with saving England in the Battle of Britain, because they were able to detect German flights coming towards their country and were able to scramble their fighters to intercept. Well, we didn't have it in this country, and so this radar was set up down there in Orlando as part of the School of Applied Tactics. Of course, the other reason was to pass on ideas of tactics to our Air Force, which was just now being developed, so that we could develop a good system for combat, which we had not had any experience with. There was a wing commander, Donaldson, that I remember from England, with a typical big long mustache, and he used to come over and lead some of the flights now and then and do some acrobatics over the field, and he was a lot of fun. We were flying at that time P-40s. We had the P-40D model, as I recall, which...
Did that have a Curtiss propeller?
You had a Curtiss propeller.
Ah, yes. Okay.
Yeah. And
I'll tell you.
Okay. Some humanness, not just technical.
I think I must tell you about my first checkout in the P-40, as a matter of fact. Of course, I mentioned I've been flying AT-6s. We got down to Orlando and to check out in the P-40, which was a little more airplane than the 86 was, the first 2 days we sat down and read tech orders and said, now do you ever understand everything about the plane? Then you got in the airplane, got a cockpit checkout. And one of the things the check pilot said, hey, you know, you got a lot of torque here and it's kind of short coupled. And one of the things you want to do is screw in about 2 or 3 degrees of right rudder, because that thing is going to pull like hell on you if you're not used to it. So I took off, got off the ground all right, got my gear up, and went and flew around a little while. It was late in the afternoon. And when I came back to the field in Orlando to land, after my first check ride and a solo ride, you should say, in a P-40, I couldn't find the airstrip. And I looked down, and I knew I was over it, but I hadn't really realized that the strip had been camouflaged so that nobody could find it. And the there were sort of artificial buildings painted out on the runway and all that. And the worst part was when I got my instructions from the tower and the azimuth in which to land, which runway to take, I wheeled around onto the runway, and on top of all the camouflage, the sun was setting, and I was landing directly into the sun, and I couldn't see. And I tell you, that was probably the most hairy ride that I had at Orlando, Florida.
Put yourself away from there with whatever tail.
After a couple of months, I became a flight leader with the 10th Fighter Squadron down there in Orlando. And we had our squadron moved to Zephyr Hills, which was on the Gulf side. Of the
That's
peninsula.
Gulf, not golf.
Not the Gulf side, the Gulf side.
He's from New Hampshire.
Yeah. And we had a strip and it was kind of isolated. And they, within the whole School of Applied Tactics, we had a couple of squadrons of fighters. And I said we were flying P-40s. There were other squadrons with bombers. And as a flight leader in this group, we received for a two-week tour squadrons from either part of the country that were headed for overseas to learn some of the tactics, like making head-on passes. And one of the things we'd do is they'd put up a flight of B-17s. Oh, yeah, and I should mention that the whole intercept was done on radar, which was entirely new to the U.S., although the British had been doing this. And so they'd put us in position where the bombers were coming in from flight control by radar, and we'd positioned into the sun above the B-17s, and then we'd make a head-on pass on the B-17s, and as soon as you got in pretty close, you'd roll over and do a split S and go under the B-17s. And this was one of the tactics that...
On Earth is a split S.
What is a split S?
Yeah.
Well, you're going... Let's say you're going straight and level, and you just roll upside down and then pull a stick back in your gut and go under the airplane.
Okay, I got it.
Go straight
down.
Well, this was part of the tactic we were training people to do. Then it was about this time that they were having combat ground tech training down in Louisiana. And they decided that they would send down two squadrons, one attached to the Blue Army and one attached to the Red Army, to support these ground troops for sort of a complete combat exercise. And our squadron got attached to the Red Army, and they painted all our P-40s bright red, sprayed them bright red. And we went down to, we took our squadron down to Barksdale Field, Louisiana, near Shreveport, and flew out of there. Well, the first mission we got was to intercept and do some ground strafing over the Blue Army, which they had intelligence was moving down through the woods. So we took our P-40s over there, and we went down and ground strafed them. Well, here are all the Army soldiers who didn't have rifles yet, carrying broomsticks and walking down the fields. And when we'd buzz them, they would wave and wave their broomsticks at us, you know. And we got back that night and landed. And we understand that the Army boys really caught hell. They said, look, when you see the Red Army come in, the Red Air Force come in and start strafing you, you get down on the ground and hide or you're going to get killed. So a couple of days later, after they got their rack back, we got another mission to do the same. And I remember coming down this dirt road, and they were hidden. They were getting down in ditches, and you couldn't see many guys. And we got lower and lower. And coming down this dirt road, the wingman guy flying my right wing hit a pine tree about 6 feet across, dead center of that P-40, and of course killed the engine and cut the tree in half. And he landed on the dirt road. He wasn't hurt. We got him back all right, destroyed that airplane pretty much. But after that particular mission, and we did any other intercepts of ground troops, we never could see one guy on the ground. They got the message. The first P-51As, production models to come out, were sent down to the School of Applied Tactics, so we got to check out in that airplane. And I might mention here that certainly the later models were a terrific airplane, the laminar wing and all that, but the A was not a very good airplane. It was underpowered, and at the moment we kind of preferred the P-40, but as you well know, the P-51 turned out to be probably the best propeller-driven fighter that we had in the war. Late in the spring, I had was leading a gunnery flight out over the Gulf, and after we got through doing our target practice, which was done by trailing a target behind one of the P-40s and the other members of the flight taking passes at that target. After we got through with that mission, I brought the flight back over the beach, and we thought we'd have a little fun, so we went down and buzzed the beach, took a couple of passes, and then went into Zephyr Hills and landed. And I got a call from the CO, hey, Gardner, come over, I want to talk to you. Did you have your flight down over the beach? And I said, gee, I don't remember. I don't think so. He says, come on, fess up. There was a ground colonel down there, and he's got a movie, the whole thing, so we got your tail number, and we know you did it. And he said, you can be in trouble because you might get court-martialed for this, but I can take care of it for you. And I said, how's that? And he said, well, there's a fighter squadron being set up in India, and you can go over and be an operations officer. And I said, I'm ready. Let's go. So I left Florida in a hurry and ended up in San Francisco waiting for a boat to take me to India. In the meantime, I ran up with a guy named Dick West, and he was from another squadron in the same area, and he was being assigned also to a squadron in India. So we got to be pretty good friends overnight, and Dick was quite a gambler, and he said, I got to go into San Francisco before the boat sails. Do you want to go in with me? And I said, yeah, and we figured the boat was going to leave sometime the next morning. We didn't get back to base till a little after midnight, and we found the boat had already sailed. So Dick and I got confined to post and said, you guys are going on the next boat out. And so 2 weeks later, sure enough, we were on the boat headed west. And we knew that we were headed in the right direction, but no one would tell us where the boat was going to dock. Well, we knew when we went by the Hawaiian Islands because they played Hawaiian music for us on the boat. And about 17 days later, we ended up in Sydney. And after unloading, we got sent out to the base, and they said, "Where are your orders?" And I said, "We don't have any." And they said, "Well, how come you're on this ship?" And we told them the story and said we were supposed to go to India. And they said, "We don't know anything about that. Why don't you go into Sydney and find a place to live, and we'll call you." Well, after about a month in Sydney, Dick and I ran out of money, and so we had to go back to the base in Sydney and report it in and said, "We got to get a sign somewhere. We don't have any money." And they said, "Well, can you fly a P-40? And we said, "Yeah, we checked out in 40s. Said, "Okay, you're going to New Guinea." So we both ended up with the 35th Fighter Squadron in Port Moresby. P-40s that we flew in New Guinea were certainly a great improvement over the D model. We had P-40 N-5s. They had extended the empennage about, as I recall, 14, 18 inches further back, so you had more, better rudder control. They'd increased the engine size, and it was really a fine performing airplane, which I don't think today many people realize the change that had really taken place in this airplane. We flew, of course, all kinds of missions. A lot of them were dive bombing, strafing, once in a while an intercept on a scramble where some enemy planes might be coming in toward the base, or quite often flying cover for bombers on a raid. The first airplane that I got shot down was a Betty bomber, which had come in and raided a base at Ley, and we got scrambled to chase them, and I caught up with this one about halfway back to Rabaul, as I recall. And didn't have enough gas to get back to Port Moresby, and I landed at Ley, and they flew in some gasoline from Port Moresby in barrels, and I was able to refuel and get back home. I guess I could ramble along about all kinds of different missions. Probably the best combat fight I really got into was when we were flying out of Finchhaven, and they were making a landing at Sador, New Guinea, which was up the coast from Finch, about halfway up to Wewak. And the ships were approaching the harbor there at Sador when Duckbutt, which is a ship, a destroyer outpost, which had radar, said that there was a large number of bogies headed our way. Well, that was a term for an enemy airplane, a bogie. And they positioned our flight. We had taken off from Finchhaven, as I recall, with 16 airplanes. One guy had engine trouble return, so it ended up with 15 of us, and we spread our ships at different altitudes, probably, as I recall, from about 25,000 down to about 10,000. And about the time we got positioned, we could see the Zeros, Hamps, and other kind of fighters coming towards us. So the 15 of us got hit by about 40 Zeros, and we had a pretty good scramble there for 20 or 30 minutes, and I was able to shoot down 3 airplanes in that fight. And in the meantime, the fighters were covering a bunch of dive bombers that were going to come in and hit the fleet below. But they got kind of scared off after we tore up, I forgot how many total planes. I think we knocked out 19 of their 40 fighters. And the dive bombers were forming up in a Loughberry down near the water. Well, another guy, Lynn Witt, and I took a pass to go down and see if we get one of the dive bombers. And when we went through, Witt went through first, and I went through afterwards, right behind him. And we both zeroed in on an airplane, pulled the trigger, and finally we were both out of ammunition. So we went on down on the deck and headed back for Finchhaven. And about that time, we were relieved by a squadron of P-47s, which had been scrambled to come in and help us out. But by that time, the Japanese offense was pretty well broken up, and they were headed back towards Rabaul.
Oh, this is fascinating.
We covered New Guinea pretty well, starting at Port Moresby, and if I recall all the various bases, I probably can't, but I remember Lae, Silly Silly, Goosap, then we were up at Finchhaven, Nadsab, and I think it was when we were at Nadsab, by then I'd had about 100 missions in P-40s, and we were having a board of court of honor review, and we're all lined up, and General Kenny was there handing out some awards, and he came up, and I was standing next to Dick West, and he said, "You know, I'm going to be able to get new airplanes for your squadron. What would you like? We can get you P-47s or P-38s. And Dick and I both said we'd prefer the 38. And sure enough, about a few months later, we did our transition from P-40s to P-38s.
Cool.
The big advantage, of course, with the P-38 was having two engines. And over the long haul over water, this paid off for several guys in various instances. The other disadvantage, maybe more than advantage, was that it extended the range a lot. The disadvantage was that it got a little sore on the behind after
right.
Some of these trips. Lindbergh came over about this time. He was, of course, fired by Franklin D. Roosevelt for being a pacifist and trying to keep us out of the war. And he had a commission as a colonel in the Army Air Corps. But he came over as a civilian for Chance Vaught, and he was sent over by them to try to sum up the advantages and disadvantages of the different fighters we had and what might be built into a new fighter for the Pacific area. And he actually got to fly some missions with us, which was kind of against the rule, but General Kenny kind of befriended him and let him fly a few times, and I actually flew a couple of missions Lindbergh was on. But the thing that he helped us with was how to get more range out of the P-38. And his secret was to pull the RPM back to about 1200 RPM. Well, the tech order said the minimum RPM you should run those liquid-cooled engines, these were Allison engines, was about 1800 RPM. Well, this was well below spec, and at the same time, pull your mixture control back towards idle cutoff until the RPM started to drop a little more, and then just kick it up a bit. Well, this really extended the range. We probably added 300 or 400 more miles to the range of the P-38. After moving up further New Guinea, we went from Nadjab up to Wakti Island, and then from there to Biak. And from Biak, we moved to the Netherlands East Indies, to Moratai. And from Moratai, we were able to make our first strikes into the Philippines. And one of the missions that turned out to be real interesting, and I had a chance to really help another guy home, was when we were over Cebu Island on a raid, and Dick West had pulled up behind a Jap plane, pretty close behind it, got a good shot, and when he did, he evidently ruptured the oil tank, and oil spattered all over Dick.
Oil spattered all over Dick's windshield, completely blinding him. He called on the radio that he was in trouble, couldn't see, and I heard him, returned his call, told him to take a heading towards Moratai, give me his heading and also his angels. He called back and said what altitude he was at, and I headed in that direction. I could see him in the distance, and about that time I saw a Japanese plane coming in from the right, and it looked like he was going to close on deck. Well, I poured the coal to it and got in position, shot down the Jap plane before he got to Dick, and then pulled in along beside Dick and asked him if he could see out his side window. He could, so I said, pull in real tight, stick your wing in under mine, and I'll fly you back towards Moratai, which we did. It was about an hour flight. When we got inside of the airport, I called the control tower, told them that we had a problem, and they'd cleared the field. And when we got into the pattern, I signaled Dick, and we both let our landing gear down together. He stayed in formation, and I flew him down over the runway. I stayed off to the left side, so he had a clear shot at the runway, which he, of course, couldn't see. And then when he got right within a few feet off the ground, I called to him, chopped the throttle, and he'd set down, and I gunned it and went around and then came in and landed. The American landings were made in the Philippines, as I recall, in October of 1944. There were several fleets, one commanded by Admiral Halsey. A Japanese fleet came through from the north, and Halsey went after that fleet and chased it north, leaving Admiral Kincaid to protect the beachhead at Leyte. At this point in time, the Japanese were quite desperate. Kincaid didn't have any big carriers. He had several what we called jeep carriers, which were smaller, and the Japanese kamikazes sunk all of the jeep carriers in the Leyte Gulf. Many of the pilots were able to get off, but had no place to return and crash landed on the beach. Our flight and others were sent out from Moratai in the Netherlands East Indies to help protect the beachhead, but of course we couldn't stay over the target too long because we had about, a 600-mile flight up, 600-mile back. Shortly after the airstrip was taken at Leyte, I was on such a mission up over the battle going on in the Leyte Gulf. I went in on a Japanese cruiser, which wasn't a very smart idea, I believe. Anyway, after strafing across the deck, the cruiser got a bead on my airplane, shot out the right engine, and I remembered a trick that was taught me way back there in the flying school. As soon as they get a bead on you, put the stick in one corner and the rudder in the other, and you'll slide sideways, which will draw their fire away if they won't be having the right lead on your airplane, and which I did. So I was able to get away, but the engine was on fire. I pulled out over the Lady Gulf, made a dive, looked down, several Japanese destroyers in the bay there, and I decided I better not bail out. Well, fortunately, the fire went out, and I skidded on up to Lady and figured I'd best bet I had was to try to get in on the Lady Strip. Well, I went in, landed, and when I did, and let down my gear, of course, the right wheel had been shot up, and I did a ground loop, and they sent a Jeep out, picked me up, and came back, and there was General MacArthur and General Kenny, and I got to talk to them a bit, and they wanted my observation of what I had seen while I was out over the bay, and it turned out that I was the first pilot to land in the Philippines after the invasion. A couple months later, we had established a beachhead on the island of Mindoro, and our squadron was then moved from Lady to Mindoro, and this was around Christmas. Mindoro was around Christmas of 1944. From Mindoro now, we were able to cover all the Philippine Islands and actually cover the landings that were made on the island of Luzon. Of course, the Japanese had most of their aircraft on the field at Clark Field, which we attacked several times and destroyed a good number of their airplanes on the ground. At this time, I was promoted to operations officer of the 8th Fighter Group, and the group consisted of the 35th Squadron, which I had been in, the 36th, and the 80th. After a few months at this job, Doc Tatum, the flight surgeon, talked to me one day and said, "Hey, look, Bill, you've got 172 missions, you've shot down 8 planes, and I think you're getting kind of combat weary, and we're getting a lot of new pilots shipped over since the war in Europe has ended, and I think I'm going to send you home." So I returned to the United States, first by boat from the Philippines to San Francisco, which took 40 days, and then I was put in charge of a troop train from Frisco over to Fort Dix, Massachusetts, where it took several more days. When I reported in at Dix and they added up the number of points, they said, "You got too many points, we're going to release you from the Army Air Corps." So I was discharged and then had to look for a job. My first thoughts, of course, were going back to the Curtiss-Wright Corporation where I started in 1941. To see if I could get my job back. Well, when I talked to the personnel people at Patterson, they said, "We're going to call over to the Pella Division, and you might go over and talk to them because I think they're looking for a test pilot, and maybe you qualify for that job." So I went over and was interviewed by Bill Long, by Ralph Girk, and Kurt Hine, and ended up being a test pilot for the Propeller Division. Many of the first tests I flew were in a P-47. The type of tests we were running were what we call speed powers, and they were evaluating different propeller shapes and designs. I remember one in particular, which was very swept-back wing. The theory being maybe like a swept-back wing at supersonic speeds, this would be more efficient. Well, as I recall, this didn't turn out to be so in propeller design, and if you'll notice, most high-speed propellers, instead of having rounded tips or swept-back tips, are cut off square, and the aerodynamics of this situation proved to be most efficient. Speed powers were usually run at fairly high altitude, as I recall, about 35,000 feet. One would attain this altitude, take a heading And Jack Casely, chief aerodynamicist, said, I want you to run 2 points downwind, then turn around and run 2 more points into the wind. And this particular day, I recall a downwind leg was taking me straight out over the Atlantic. I ran my 2 points, which are at maximum power with water injection, to get maximum speed, of course, and then turned around and headed back, ran my 2 points, looked down and couldn't see anything but water, and I flew and flew. Finally, the coastline came into view, and when I landed, I went over and talked to the weather people, and I said, what was the wind today? And it turned out I was up in the jet stream, which was running about 250 knots, and took me way out over the Atlantic. Kurt Hein talked to me one day and said, we want to see if we can't even get higher speeds out of that jug than we're getting out of the straight and level flights. So we've developed a thrust meter. Of course, the engine, as delivered from the factory, had a torque meter, so one could measure torque in flight. The thrust meter was a straightforward design in that the thrust bearing on the propeller and on the propeller gearbox was set up with a oil line going to a gauge behind the bearing, such that as the thrust increased on the bearing, the pressure would increase to keep it in a neutral balanced position, and the amount of pressure would indicate the amount of thrust the propeller was delivering. Well, in order to do this, one had to plug the main oil system to the propeller gearbox, which ran up through the prop shaft. So that was plugged. In order to lubricate these gears, an external line was run up into the gearbox, which would not affect the thrust measurement. Well, one day I was flying such a flight, and I was up over West Point, as I recall, and the way one would set this flight up, you go up about 40,000 feet, give it full throttle, turn on water injection, and then do a split S and go straight down until you hit compressibility. And the jug P-47 would hit compressibility at about Mach 0.95. At this point, the controls start to go all over the airplane, and the plane would try to duck over on its back. And the Republic Aircraft Company had experienced this before. In fact, it lost a test pilot, and they had developed a flap under the wing, which was electrically controlled, which is a spoiler. So as soon as this happened, you chop the throttle, push a button, the spoilers would come down and allow you to get out of this compressibility. And usually it hit it around 20,000 feet, and it hit the flap, chop the throttle, and pull on out. This particular day, about the time I did that, that external oil line broke, and like I told about Dick West, pumped oil over the windshield and I couldn't see. Well, I thought the best bet was to head down toward Caldwell and get as close as I can, but stay away from any of the towns. And when I got down to around 8,000 feet, I'd let the canopy go and see where I was and jump out, because I couldn't see through the windshield. Well, I got down to 8,000 feet and on the heading, as I said, towards Caldwell. And by the end, the engine was about to die because it wasn't getting oil. It pumped most of the oil overboard. So I chopped the engine back, let the canopy go, and I looked out, and lo and behold, off my left wing, I saw the strip at Caldwell. Serendipity, I guess. And so I headed over that way, gave him a mayday call, and of course the only way I could see was to hang my head over the side, and inhaled a lot of oil, and I dead-sticked it, landed on the field of call while they came out and towed me off. I think Kurt, after that, gave me 2 or 3 days off to get the oil out of my system. About this same time, reverse pitch was being developed, and of course, Curtis Propeller had the edge on the ham standard people to develop a reverse pitch design, because all one had to do was to speed up the control motor on the changing the blade angle, take off the low pitch stop, and we boosted the voltage, and you could reverse the propeller blades right through the flat angle and back into reverse in just a few seconds. Well, we put a reverse pitch propeller on the P-47 jug, and we were going to try to sell this to the Navy as a dive bombing brake, and so I'd take it up to 30,000-40,000 feet, do a split S, put it in reverse, give it full throttle, and you could sit there with your nose straight down at about 150-200 knots indicated. But things were changing rapidly. Looked like jet aircraft were going to be taken over, so this idea as a dive bombing brake didn't sell. But what did sell, of course, was using this for landing on larger, heavier transport and bomber aircraft. The Wright Aeronautical Engine Division had a hangar on the other side of the airport. The chief test pilot there was Fred Chamberlain, and one of the aircraft they used for testing was a B-17. And so the B-17 was equipped with reverse pitch, and several times I went over and flew co-pilot with Fred on that B-17. I remember one particular flight, we had some French visitors, and we're going to, see if we couldn't sell reverse pitch to the French. So we took them up on a flight, came in on the short runway down over the golf course. As I recall, it was just a few hundred feet to the first intersection of the runway going the other direction. And Fred and I brought it around, and we had worked out a little trick, which later became illegal. But as Fred would flare out as we came off the golf course just over the end of the runway, I'd hit the reverse button before we touched down. And, of course, we stopped flying pretty quickly, squatted down, and then full power on, and we could turn off the first intersection. And right behind us was standing our French visitor behind Fred and I, looking out through the windshield. And as we came down that runway, down over the golf course onto that short runway, I heard the Frenchman say, "Ooh la la!" And then when we hit the reverse and turned off the intersection, I think we sold the French a few propellers. Another innovation of the propeller division was the development of heated blades for de-icing. Of course, some systems use fluid, which was ejected out over the blade when you got an icing situation. And this particular test we were running was on heated blades. Well, in order to get the icing conditions, we had on this B-17, we had a boom out over number 3 engine, which would spray water from a tank which was back in the bomb bay. And I remember one day I was flying with Fred. We had gone to the correct altitude, and we'd pick an altitude where you got just a few degrees below freezing. We'd turn on the spray and really get a good chunk of ice out there and test the de-icing system. Well, after this test, we then go out over the ocean, shake the airplane, make sure we get all the ice off before we came back and landed. This one particular day, there was still a big chunk of it was hung inside the cowl on the number 3 engine. And when we turned to come in over the approach to Curtis Field, the Caldwell Field, the big chunk of ice fell off, and unbeknownst to us, went through a greenhouse which was out there off the end of the runway. And we hadn't much to land, and we got a telephone call, and I think we had to buy some new flowers and glass for the greenhouse operator. The president of the Curtiss-Wright Corporation had a C-46. Which had been equipped at the Columbus plant, rather plush for his private use. Herb Fisher came in with that airplane one day, and I flew co-pilot with him. We took the president out to a meeting of other aircraft company presidents at an ABRA ranch in Wyoming. After leaving them for a week, we had the assignment to take the airplane down to demonstrate reverse pitch to Continental Airlines at Denver. So we took the airplane down there and landed, and then after we landed, we taxied and right up to the control tower and put the nose almost up the control tower. And of course, everybody in the tower at that point was frantic and screaming at us, and what do you think you're doing? I'll get a tug and pull you back out. And we shoved it in reverse. First time anybody up there seen reverse pitch. And we backed away from the tower and parked, and you never heard the noise that came out of the control tower. Other aircraft we had at the propeller division that I remember testing were the C-82 cargo plane, and also probably the most fun airplane was the F-8F Bearcat, which was developed by Grumman and came out just at the end of the war. Never did see combat in World War II, but I believe it was used at the beginning of the Vietnam War or some.
This is great, Bill. Thank you for recording so many memories. However, since I have your permission, I'll add some facts that you didn't record. You were in the South Pacific for 4 years and flew 176 missions, thus accumulated too many points to remember. For this, you received a Silver Star, 2 Distinguished Flying Crosses, and 8 Air Medals. Plus, your outfit received 2 Presidential Citations. Could this be the reason you were kept overtime out there? The Army Air Corps needed the good guys, and you must have been the best. Thanks again.